Park Place Meeting, Monday morning, 26th of May, 1975. I trust the experiment we attempted yesterday afternoon has proved fruitful in some degree or other. When inner disharmonies between two people find release, what we could call a powerful karmic source of future trouble is completely resolved. True understanding for oneself what is in a state of disharmony and opening out one's heart and mind to another who also understands thereby, then there is the restoration of peace between the two. You know that remarkable beatitude, blessed are the peacemakers. And peace means complete release of all tensions within the soul. When this happens, there is quite naturally the state of love, where there is no emotion or sentimentality involved. This means that the mind has taken a step forward to maturity. And with every step forward to maturity, the real function of the mind, namely to exercise pure intelligence, is free to operate. Intelligence in this context means perceiving the truth of things as they are. Unhampered by conditioning, by fixed ideas, by the whole of the known past. And this is very important. Because one of the deep meanings of truth in the religious sense is the immediate perception in the here now of what is actually present, of what is actually happening, undistorted by criteria and beliefs and so on taken over from the past. This is something which the vast mass of human beings never experience. They never realize, because we are the creatures of our conditioning. We are imprisoned by it. This is not to suggest that all conditioning is wrong, far from it. The moment in which we live, as soon as it is past, is just one step behind us, so to say. That moment has died for us. its impress upon the whole psyche is inevitably a conditioning factor. Inevitably. The difficulty comes here that because we do not quite understand this matter, we cling to that conditioning. We say, well, I've learned this lesson. I have seen this. And then we cling to what we have seen, but we are clinging to that which is past, instead of looking into the immediate now, which is fresh, which is new. In other words, we do not know the art of dying completely to the passing moment. You see, the great pulse of life in every aspect, from the transcendent right down to the biological, is a pulsation. This pulse of life is commonly described, has been described in the past by those great holy ones who really saw as the life-death pulse. As you know, I prefer to use the term the life-other life pulse. And I prefer to use the term other life and not death, for the simple reason that our ordinary experience and our conditioning imposes the idea of complete extinction, annihilation, in association with the word death. This is our difficulty. Death is not annihilation. It is an undergoing of a change of such an extraordinary nature that we think that, oh, this is the complete and absolute end. It isn't that. It is this life, other life pulse. But it entails a movement from the state, out of the state of being, into the state of non-being, back into the state of being, back into the state of non-being. It's a pulsation here and now. Life, eternity, immortality, the immeasurable, the indestructible, that which is never born, never begins, all these are coterminous. It is our consciousness, our awareness, which is at fault. It is not yet sufficiently awakened. Immortality is here now. Not afterwards, not tomorrow. If you look into the word immortality, not mortality, you will see that the reality of immortality cannot be held within the constraints of conceptual thinking. Because all conceptual thinking as such deals with the finite, not with the non-finite. Now, if one begins to see this, one begins to understand the imperative importance of completely working out everything in the immediate now as it arises. One can't work out things physically like that, because the physical world is a world of time and space, and it has procedure, a movement from one point to another. It is not a pulsation in the immediate here now. But our consciousness, our minds function in the here now. It's a pulsation here now. And this can be worked out fully. In other words, one is awake as completely as possible to the immediate now and does not grasp at anything in the immediate now. Perceive the immediate now fully and work it, let it work itself out in the mind. There is nothing left over to be worked out later on. But this is precisely what we do not do, and we cannot do, because we are incapable still. So you see, if we do not grasp at anything which is experienced now, we have, to use the common word, completely died to the passing moment, which does in fact pass inevitably, and it belongs to the realm of the dead. If we can let it go completely, we have completely died to the past. We are living now. And in that living now, there is the realizing of immortality. Because immortality is not a continuity in time. This is one of the very difficult things to see and understand. What does this imply on the practical side? It implies, and this is what is so important for human beings, it implies that there is no unworked out and grasped mental impression. Whatever mental impression emerges through the experience of the immediate now, insofar as it is unworked out, insofar as it is grasped, sinks into the well of the unconscious. And because it is unworked out, and because it is an actual psychical force, it remains as a debt. Sooner or later, some stimulus in our life comes along, which calls up this unworked out energy. And it is an obstruction to us. Now, this is how we should try to understand the Hindu-Buddhist teaching about karma, this word karma. We look at it too mechanically. We look at it as a process of retribution. as a debit credit account. It is nothing of the sort. It is a living process here now. Whatsoever is unworked out remains within us. And it operates, continuously operates. If it is unworked out, it operates as a retarding force, as a force which prevents us from being utterly clean and pure. No human being can escape his karma. Every single thought, feeling, word, action, everything that comprises our life registers its impress upon the psyche. Do not think of the psyche as some mysterious entity which is not solid, liquid, gaseous. Do not think of it that way. Whatever registers in the psyche, or if you like to use the other word, the mind, whatever registers, and everything does make its impress, registers in the whole psychophysical being. So that it is not registered exclusively in some mysterious separate entity called the mind, but it registers in the very body. We now know, even scientifically, objectively scientifically, that every single thought or feeling is accompanied by electrical and chemical changes in the body itself. So you see, every thought, feeling, word, action is a living process which immediately bears fruit in the living body itself. There is no justicia, there is no department in heaven or hell or anywhere where there is a record kept of everyone's deeds and all the rest of it. There's no such thing. The record is here, right within your living body. We are constituted that way. You see? And because these are actual forces, right down to the physical level of electricity and chemistry, therefore they are operating all the time. If we are people who give vent to ill temper, well, there may come a day when one has an apoplectic fit, and goodness knows what might happen. That is, of course, the dramatic, perhaps traumatic expression of the working out of karma. It is I who am giving vent to that bad temper. And therefore, the consequence comes upon me first and foremost straight away. But it doesn't stop there. So far, we have been talking in terms of a person as an exclusive entity, separate from the world. But none of us is separate from the world. Not one. We may try to run away from the world in cave or cloister or wherever it is, but can we run away from the world? Because there is the world, this particular living organism continues to live. Supposing the world disappeared, heat, light, air, matter, everything disappeared. This would disappear with it. It would be totally impossible for this to subsist. But for the actual physical fact of this perpetual interplay between the what we call the external world and what we call ourselves. So, all our psychical processes, all our thinking and feeling process, which is inextricably bound up with what we commonly call the bodily processes. All this is completely related, interrelated with everything else, with the whole environment. Now you see how we are affected by what we commonly call the environment, the other person, the situation, and so forth, and how we affect it. So our responsibility is not merely to ourselves or merely to a postulated God of divinity or whatever it is. Because whatsoever the mind postulates is a finite postulation. It is not the total reality, the infinite reality. So our responsibility is to the totality. To live self-responsibly really means to live with a full awareness of our responsibility to transcendence itself, the one and only self of the whole universe. That is self-responsible living. Now, if we can be awake to that extent, then we cling to nothing whatsoever. There is nothing which is unworked out. There is no karmic debt, so to say, accumulating. To put it in another form, this distinction which we make between the conscious and the unconscious in us vanishes. Everything comes within the clear light. There is no darkness anywhere. This is one of the deep meanings of enlightenment in Buddhist terms, of Christ consciousness in Christian terms, of the realization of Atma in Hindu terms, and so on. Then the mind is the whole mind. There is no conscious division between conscious and unconscious in it. There is complete awareness here now. That is man's destiny. Someday the human race will consist of a majority of people, at least, who are like that quite naturally. Mankind come to fruition at last through an age-long period of gestation and of slow maturing. But you and I, if we begin to understand this and see this, we can contribute positively, concretely, to the evolution of mankind as such and its development. You remember, we talked a little bit about this plucking of the fruit of the tree of life. And that fruit is consciousness. It is this kind of total consciousness, which is total light, which is the real fruit. But in plucking it, and man has to pluck it and eat it, in plucking it, because we are still incapable of living up to what all the implications of eating that fruit, we scar the tree of life, and it becomes for us the tree of good and evil, as we call it. In transcendence, there is neither what we call good nor what we call evil. Our good and evil is a relative evil. Transcendence embraces and understands the whole, the totality. If it didn't, these mysterious phenomena of grace, of redemption, would have no possibility of occurring. Our relative good and evil emerges out of our very constitution. The physical body has a pleasure-pain mechanism. It must have a pleasure-pain mechanism operating, otherwise the body would perish. Where the difficulty comes in is here. When we experience a pleasurable sensation, the psychological counterpart is, oh, I like this, I want more of it. When we experience something displeasurable, painful physically, we say, oh, I don't like this, I must get rid of it, I must be away from it. And if what I experience is displeasurable enough, I want to destroy it. So we get, on the one hand, craving, lust. On the other hand, aversion, hate. And we are conscious of our existence fundamentally in these terms. Craving and hate. We are discriminatively conscious. And as long as we are discriminatively conscious only, in this conflicting sense of discriminative consciousness, we will always have conflict and confusion and darkness. But when we are totally attentive, our faculty of discrimination is not lessened. We recognize white as white and black as black and so on. But psychically, we do not say, I like this, I don't like that. We don't exercise preferential choice in relation to a separate self. We understand the wholeness of the situation. And in that understanding, right action follows. Action which is utterly pure, utterly untainted. Of course, you will see at once, this is a tremendously difficult task. But of course, all coming to fruition, which involves a withinness in operation, with the power of choice, is bound to be an extremely difficult task. Look at trees and so forth. Nature brings them all to fruition. There is a sort of a blueprint, a pattern. Yes, thus and thus it will be. If the winds blow thus, The trees cannot say, well, I don't want to be bent this way and grow like that. I'll look ugly. Fortunately, trees have no mirrors to look into. Trees just inevitably respond to the forces at play upon them. But that means that the tree has no withinness. The tree cannot look within, contemplate the within, the without, and become aware of something utterly transcendent to itself. You and I can do that. We can become aware of transcendence. And we produce difficulty when we begin to be aware of transcendence, and this is one of the first results of eating of the fruit of the tree of life. Unfortunately, we postulate a divinity. We say, God is like this, that, and the other. This is sacrilege. I don't know. Where there is worship, one closes one's eyes. Where there is the utter intensity of love and self-giving, don't you close your eyes. You do instinctively that which is the truth of things. You don't presume to look, because we look outwardly with our eyes analytically, and in looking analytically we sunder the reality. This is sacrilegious. This is what causes sin. This is the discriminative consciousness which is the source of trouble. This discrimination which lives by preferential choice. I like, I don't like. But supposing transcendence says, my dear child, I want such and such a manifestation to take place through you, and a different manifestation to take place through you. Transcendence may withhold your flowering in order to demonstrate its transcendence. It may allow all your inborn abilities and qualities to come to flower and you become famous and all the rest of it in the world. But both ways, it is transcendence. A very hard lesson to learn. The consolations which the Lord sends and the tribulations which the Lord sends. It is my business to exercise no preferential choice, but to be totally attentive so that there is nothing unworked out, nothing which splits my mind into a conscious part and an unconscious part where all the karmic debt accumulates. You see how important, therefore, it is to understand that we have to stand on our own feet. And to stand on our own feet must not be misinterpreted as, I am going to do just exactly what I see is right. Be very careful, be very circumspect. I see this is right, and so forth. Failing to see my conditioning, my hidden desires, all my selfness imposing itself upon the totality. And the totality is transcendence, is God, is the ultimate, the supreme, everything, the universe. If we understand this, perhaps you'll appreciate why, at the end of that letter which you found in your room when you came, after that quotation from St. Teresa, we had that quotation from the saying, teaching of the Buddha, he who has no self-obtrusiveness may rightly speak the word of truth. Now, I would like to read you just a little bit on this matter of the one and the many. It's something which causes considerable trouble to philosopher and theologian and to ordinary folk like myself in the world. The matter is really quite simple. Wholeness is one. The one in wholeness is the harmony of the many. When I am in the pure state, still and silent, I am fully sensitive to the harmony of the many. This harmony is the oneness of the one. To live the holy life means, therefore, that my life, as it moves through conditions of dissonance and assonance circumstantially, is a song of life. As long as I remain the bond slave of worldliness, it is a cacophony. To transform it into a song, only one step is needed, namely, to step out into the void, the unknown. That is the one and only step needed, to step out into the void, the unknown. It is a stepping into pure mind, the mind of God. The mind of God has none of the thoughts of men. What does this mean in earthly fact? It means that I am constantly ceasing to grasp at and to cling to the known. For the known is finite and restrictive. And as long as I cling to it, or put my faith in it, the immeasurable truth cannot fill me with its light. I discover that I must not cling to any formal expression claiming to be truth. That is to say, the fixed and the ultimate truth. Certainly, I must never search for such expression. Forms or expressions inevitably emerge. Any and every form expresses the living truth only if I let it freely have its temporal life, that is, let it change or grow and pass away. And that is the important point. Let it pass away. Don't cling to it. Otherwise, the brighter light of truth cannot emerge within us if we cling to the old light as such. Not that the old light was untrue or any such thing, not at all. The change takes place not where truth is concerned, but in my awareness of it. That is what changes. It is that which intensifies. If I dispense with form finding, and therefore also with fault finding with the old form, and let my senses and attention be unconditionally awake without interference from concepts, memories, and experiences, all of which belong to the static known, then I am the truth. For in such awakenedness and unconditionality, there is freedom from my will or desire or thought. Then I do not obtrude on the world, which is the perpetual flow of expressions, nor do I obstruct transcendence, the unknown, which is the timeless real. To step into the void is thus to step into the death of the known, which means to step into the other life of the known. Each moment of my daily life. It is this death which spells resurrection. Out of limited being into infinite non-being. I am life immortal and also death. Being and non-being am I, said Krishna. And also, all-consuming death am I, and the source of all things to come. If we can understand this along these lines, then we'll understand what those paradoxes mean. Death and resurrection is here now, on and in earth. Earth, the existential me, opens up. There is nothing grasped, nothing closing in. The existential me opens up. Every grave opens if I do not cling to it, and delivers up the dead, the known, transmuted into renewed life. In perfect communion, when earth opens up, a son of God, a liberated holy one, joins the hosts of light. Death and resurrection, a constant pulsation, means the real fullness of human life. The meaning of Phoenix. When the final death of me, the psychophysical existent, is at hand, may I be perfectly ready to die. That means completely relinquish bodily existence. Let me not die till I have truly learned to cease to cling to any and every form in which life clothes itself, including the form of bodily death. Life uses that form too. Life is eternal. Life knows no death. Or to any and every contingent appearance of the Absolute. If I do die unready, non-being will have to constrict itself and express another being, ignorant, in the ill state, the victim of craving. Even during my bodily lifetime, I go through a million deaths unready, and thus there are a million demons hidden inside me, awaiting redemption. And you see how that redemption can come. In the stillness, in the silence, in the state of non-obtrusiveness of the self upon the totality, All those demons within which cause so much conflict and misery and sorrow, they are lit up by the light of consciousness. When you perceive them for what they are, none of the demons are ever destroyed. They are transmuted, which means, in factual terms, that psychical energy which is distorted, which is ill, it's the illness of the mind, that psychical energy is liberated. It is now disentangled, so to say, no longer distorted. And the mind functions as a whole in utter purity. And this is the miracle which is brought about, which can be brought about by pure attentiveness. The attentiveness which is without desire of any sort, whether we call it a good desire or an evil desire. Because our good is a petty good beside the transcendent good. The transcendent good will operate if I cease to obstruct it. And that is one of the deep meanings of the living of the holy life. I cannot do anything, because the I concept is a separative concept. It cuts me off. I cut myself off from the transcendent real, and therefore prevent the one and only that can bring true redemption. You see what meditation means then. We think of meditation as a process, an intellectual, emotional process. We hold on to the ritualistic part of it. We go through a ceremony, so to say. We use words, discursive meditation. Of course we have to start that way, because we know no different. But we must not hold fast, cling to the ritualistic aspect, because that is merely a set of words which may produce a temporary effect which is pleasant. But a temporary effect which is pleasant is dope. You know, when you have gone through a period which, because of the circumstance, it may be that you have gone through an uplifting religious ceremony, whether it be Hindu or Buddhist or Christian or any other, or maybe you have been in company in a lovely, secluded, quiet place which is most elevating and so forth, and you feel very, very fine. Now, you get into the train, you come back to the city, and the very first stimulus which is unpleasant or disturbing gets a terrific reaction of devilish anger and disapproval and hate from you at it. What's happened to all my goodness? You see why Jesus said, "Why callest thou me good? There is only one that is good, and that is God." You see the sense of it, the common sense, the good sense of it. Goodness is not restricted here. It is in its unperverted perfection in transcendence itself. Let that operate. Be the pure chalice, that's all, the clean temple. And then the Lord comes in, is there. So now, let us just recall, call back to mind, this point about dying to the known. To die to the known, to die completely to the immediate experience, means that you have attended to it so completely, so utterly, that there is nothing left over. Everything is worked out in that activity of attention, attentiveness. That is the way, I say it with great diffidence, that is the way that God is omniscient. They say of the great teachers, the founders of the religions, that they were omniscient. Not encyclopedic knowledge. Very likely they would have failed our O-levels, or at least our A-levels. Not that kind of knowledge. This power of attentiveness. This power, this faculty of pure intelligence to see the truth exactly as it is, straight away, just like that. And when that comes, there is reverence. Reverence for life. Reverence for truth. And oneself is truly man.